Chapter 4. When the Mistrumps have post horses to their carriage and pay visits, Grunzel always goes behind. Those ladies have the greatest confidence in him, have been godmothers to 14 of his children, and leave their house in his charge when they go to Bognor for the summer. He attended those ladies when they were presented at the last drawing room of Her Majesty Queen Charlotte. George Grunzel, greengrocer and salesman, 9 Little Pocklington Buildings, late confidential servant in the family of the Lord Mayor of London. Carpet speed. Knives and boots cleaned per contract. Errands faithfully perform. GG attends ball and dinner parties, and from his knowledge of the most distinguished families in London, confidently recommends his services to the distinguished neighborhood of Pocklington Square. Mr. Grunzel's state costume is a blue coat and copper buttons, a white waistcoat, and an immense frill and shirt collar. He was for many years a private watchman, and once canvassed for the office of parish clerk of St. Peter's Pocklington. He can be interested with untold spoons, with anything, in fact, but liquor, and it was he who brought round the cards for Mrs. Perkins' ball. After supper. I do not intend to say any more about it. After the people had supped, they went back and danced. Some supped again. I gave Miss Bunion, with my own hands, 4 bumpers of champagne, and such a quantity of goose liver and truffles, that I don't wonder she took a glass of cherry brandy afterwards. The gray morning was in Pocklington Square as she drove away in her fly. So did the other people go away. How green and sallow some of the girls looked, and how awfully clear Mrs. Colonel Bluteer's rouge was. Lady Jane Ranville's great coach had roared away down the streets long before. Fred Minchin pattered off in his clogs. It was I who covered up Miss Meggett, and conducted her, with her 2 old sisters, to the carriage. Good old souls! They have shown their gratitude by asking me to tea next Tuesday. Methuselah's gone to finish the night at the club. In tomorrow, Miss Trotter says, kissing her hand out of the carriage. Canaler departs, asking the way to Esther Square. They all go away, life goes away. Look at Miss Martin and young Ward. How tenderly the rogue is wrapping her up, how kindly she looks at him. The old folks are whispering behind as they wait for their carriage. What is their talk, think you? And when shall that pair make a match? When you see those pretty little creatures with their smiles and their blushes, and their pretty ways, would you like to be the Grand Bashaw? Mind and send me a large piece of cake, I go up and whisper archly to old Mr. Ward. And we look on rather sentimentally at the couple, almost the last in the rooms there, I declare, go the musicians, and the clock is at 5, when Grunzel, with an air effort, rushes up to me and says, for heaven's sake, sir, go into the supper room. There's that Irish gent a pitchin' into Mr. P. The Mulligan and Mr. Perkins. It was too true. I had taken him away after supper. He ran after Miss Little's carriage, who was dying in love with him as he fancied, but the brute had come back again. The doctors of divinity were putting up their condiments. Everybody was gone, but the abominable Mulligan sat swinging his legs at the lonely supper table. Perkins was opposite, gasping at him. The Mulligan. I tell ye are the butler, ye big fat man. Go get me some more champagne. It's good at this house. Mr. Perkins, with dignity, it is good at this house, but the Mulligan. B.H.T. Watt, ye goggling, bow-window jackass. Go get the wine, and we'll drink it together, my old buck. Mr. Perkins. My name, sir, is Perkins. The Mulligan. Well, that rhymes with jerkins, my man of firkins. So don't let us have any more shirkings and lurkings, Mr. Perkins. Mr. Perkins, with apoplectic energy. Sir, I am the master of this house, and I order you to quit it. I'll not be insulted, sir. I'll send for a policeman, sir. What do you mean, Mr. Titmarsh, sir, by bringing this beast into my house, sir? At this, with a scream like that of a Hyrcanian tiger, Mulligan of the Hundred Battles sprang forward at his prey, but we were beforehand with him. Mr. Gregory, Mr. Grunzel, Sir Giles Bacon's large man, the young gentleman, and myself, rushed simultaneously upon the tipsy chieftain, and confined him. The doctors of divinity looked on with perfect indifference. That Mr. Perkins did not go off in a fit is a wonder. He was led away heaving and snorting frightfully. Somebody smashed Mulligan's hat over his eyes, and I led him forth into the silent morning. The chirrup of the birds, the freshness of the rosy air, and a penn'orth of coffee that I got for him at a stall in the Regent Circus, revived him somewhat. When I quitted him, he was not angry but sad. He was desirous, it is true, of avenging the wrongs of Erin in battle line. He wished also to share the grave of Sarsfield and Hugh O'Neill, but he was sure that Miss Perkins, as well as Miss Little, was desperately in love with him, and I left him on a doorstep in tears. Is it best to be laughing mad, or crying mad, in the world? Says I moodily, coming into my street. Betsy the maid was already up and at work, on her knees, scouring the steps, and cheerfully beginning her honest daily labor. Our street, by Mr. M. A Titmarsh. Our street, from the little nook which I occupy in it, and whence I and a fellow lodger and friend of mine cynically observe it, presents a strange motley scene. We are in a state of transition. We are not as yet in the town, and we have left the country, where we were when I came to lodge with Mrs. Camisole, my excellent landlady. I then took second floor apartments at number 17 Waddleof Street, and since, although I have never moved, having various little comforts about me, I find myself living at No. 46A, Pocklington Gardens. Why is this? Why am I to pay 18 shillings instead of 15? I was quite as happy in Waddleof Street, but the fact is, a great portion of that venerable old district has passed away, and we are being absorbed into the splendid new white stucco Doric portico genteel Pocklington quarter. Sir Thomas Gibbs Pocklington, MP for the borough of Lethamplester, is the founder of the district and his own fortune. The Pocklington estate office is in the square, on a line with Waddle with Pocklington Gardens I mean. The old inn, the Am and Magpie, where the market gardeners used to bait, came out this year with a new white face and title, the Shield, and Sea of the Pocklington Arms. Such a shield it is. Such quarterings. Howard, Cavendish, De Rose, De La Zouch, all mingled together. Even our house, 46A, which Mrs. Camisole has had painted white in compliment to the gardens, of which it now forms part, is a sort of impostor, and has no business to be called gardens at all. Mr. Gibbs, Sir Thomas's agent and nephew, is furious at our daring to take the title which belongs to our betters. The very next door, number 46, the Honorable Mrs. Mountnady, is a house of 5 stories, shooting up proudly into the air, 30 feet above our old high-roofed, low-roomed old tenement. Our house belongs to Captain Bragg, not only the landlord, but the son-in-law of Mrs. Camisole, who lives a couple of hundred yards down the street, at the bungalow. He was the commander of the Umchunder East Indiaman, and has quarreled with the Pocklingtons ever since he bought houses in the parish. He it is who will not sell, or alter his houses, to suit the spirit of the times. He it is who, though he made the widow Camisole change the name of her street, will not pull down the house next door, nor the baker's next, nor the iron bedstead and feather warehouse ensuing, nor the little barber's with the pole, nor, I am ashamed to say, the tripe shop, still standing. The barber powders the heads of the great footmen from Pocklington Gardens. They are so big, that they can scarcely sit in his little premises. And the old tavern, the Ast Indiaman, is kept by Bragg's ship steward, and protests against the Pocklington Arms. Down the road is Pocklington Chapel, Rev. Oldham Slocum in brick, with arched windows and a wooden belfry. Sober, dingy, and hideous. In the center of Pocklington Gardens rises St. Wolfius, the Rev. Cyril Thurifer and assistant say splendid Anglo-Norman edifice. Vast, rich, elaborate, brand new, and intensely old. Down Avemary Lane you may hear the clink of the little Romish chapel bell. And hard by is a large broad-shouldered Ebenezer Rev. Jonas Grano, out of the windows of which the hymns come booming all Sunday long. Going westward along the line, we come presently to Commandant House on a part of the gardens, of which Commandant Gardens is about to be erected by his lordship. Farther on, the Pineries, Mr. and Lady Mary Mango. And so we get into the country, and out of our street altogether, as I may say. But in the half mile, over which it may be said to extend, we find all sorts and conditions of people from the Right Honorable Lord Commandant down to the present topographer, who being of no rank as it were, has the fortune to be treated on almost friendly footing by all, from his lordship down to the tradesman. Our house and our street, we must begin our little descriptions, where they say charity should begin at home. Mrs. Camisole, my landlady, will be rather surprised when she reads this, and finds that a good-natured tenant, who has never complained of her impositions for 15 years, understands every one of her tricks, and treats them, not with anger, but with scorn, with silent scorn. On the 18th of December, 1837 for instance, coming gently downstairs, and before my usual wont, I saw you seated in my armchair, peeping into a letter that came from my aunt in the country, just as if it had been addressed to you, and not to .a. Titmarsh Esquire. Did I make any disturbance? Far from it. I slunk back to my bedroom, being enabled to walk silently in the beautiful pair of worsted slippers Miss Penelope J.S. worked for me. They are worn out now, dear Penelope. And then rattling open the door with a great noise, descending the stairs, singing on Virgin Vizosa at the top of my voice. You were not in my sitting room, Mrs. Camisole, when I entered that apartment. You have been reading all my letters, papers, manuscripts, browlons of verses, inchoate articles for the Morning Post and Morning Chronicle, invitations to dinner and tea, all my family letters, all Eliza Townley's letters, from the first, in which she declared that to be the bride of her beloved Michel Agnolo was the fondest wish of her maiden heart, to the last, in which she announced that her Thomas was the best of husbands, and signed herself Liza Slager. All Mary Farmer's letters, all Emily Delamere's, all that poor foolish old Miss McWhirter's, whom I would as soon marry as colon in a word, I know that you hawk-beaked, keen-eyed, sleepless, indefatigable old Mrs. Camisole, have read all my papers for these 15 years. I know that you cast your curious old eyes over all the manuscripts which you find in my coat pockets and those of my pantaloons, as they hang in a drapery over the door handle of my bedroom. I know that you count the money in my green and gold purse, which Lucy Netterville gave me, and speculate on the manner in which I have laid out the difference between today and yesterday. I know that you have an understanding with the laundress, to whom you say that you are all-powerful with me, threatening to take away my practice from her, unless she gets up gratis some of your fine linen. I know that we both have a pennyworth of cream for breakfast, which is brought in the same little can, and I know who has the most for her share. I know how many lumps of sugar you take from each pound as it arrives. I have counted the lumps, you old thief, and for years have never said a word, except to Miss Clapperclaw, the first floor lodger. Once I put a bottle of pale brandy into that cupboard, of which you and I only have keys, and the liquor wasted and wasted away until it was all gone. You drank the whole of it, you wicked old woman. You a lady, indeed. I know your age, when they did me the honor to elect me a member of the Alifloy Spoiophilus' Club, and I ceased consequently to dine at home. When I did dine at home, on a beefsteak let us say, I should like to know what you had for supper. You first amputated portions of the meat when raw, you abstracted more when cooked. Do you think I was taken in by your flimsy pretenses? I wonder how you could dare to do such things before your maids, you a clergyman's daughter and widow, indeed, whom you yourself were always charging with roguery. Yes, the insolence of the old woman is unbearable, and I must break out at last. If she goes off in a fit at reading this, I am sure I shan't mind. As he has two unhappy wenches, against whom her old tongue is clacking from morning till night. She pounces on them at all hours. It was but this morning at 8, when poor Molly was brooming the steps, and the baker paying her by no means unmerited compliments, that my landlady came whirling out of the ground floor front, and sent the poor girl whimpering into the kitchen. Were it but for her conduct to her maids, I was determined publicly to denounce her. These poor wretches she causes to lead the lives of demons, and not content with bullying them all day, she sleeps at night in the same room with them, so that she may have them up before daybreak, and scold them while they are dressing. Certain it is, that between her and Miss Clapperclaw, on the first floor, the poor wenches lead a dismal life. It is to you that I owe most of my knowledge of our neighbors. From you it is that most of the facts and observations contained in these brief pages are taken. Many a night, over our tea, have we talked amiably about our neighbors and their little failings. And as I know that you speak of mine pretty freely, why, let me say, my dear Bessie, that if we have not built up our street between us, at least we have pulled it to pieces. The Bungalow Captain and Mrs. Bragg. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.